Good afternoon, good morning, good evening to those of you in Europe and other parts of the world where it's already dark. It's really a pleasure to welcome you to a Q&A session and also to just share with you the word that came to my mind is intensity of Sanskrit chanting, especially of these verses, these sutras, that are so embedded in an ancient yoga tradition. And you can think of yogis chanting these verses over and over and over again for years at a time and perhaps feel the natural transmission that comes from the verses, from the sutras themselves. So we're going to get right into the Q&A, but first, let's chant the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave mantras and just also take a moment as we start to become aware of everybody who's on this call and the people who are going to be tuning in later. You're here from all over the world. There are a lot of us. And so I'm assuming that Deb has some of the questions already listed, so we'll start with the questions that Deb asks, and then you'll have a chance to raise your hand and ask a question. And when we get to that point, I'm going to ask Deb to get online and explain the process. So let's find a posture and just let the breath bring your awareness down to the base and up through the crown. And let's just take a moment as we set our posture through the breath to acknowledge the blessings that so many of you have been offering into this satsang, to me particularly, and to all of us. There was as many of you know, there was a kind of an impulse that went through the listserv to actually offer blessings to anybody in this sangham who is in need of healing, whether it's physical or the kind of deep samskaric healing that a lot of us are going through. So in sharing blessing, we actually bring the power of our own sadhana, our own practice, our own clarity of mind in a very powerful and helpful way. So tuning into that sense of blessing, that sense that we are all actually being held in blessing, in each other's blessing, in the blessing of Shiva, in the blessing of the goddess, in the blessings of all our lineage, holding masters and guides and unknown teachers, known and unknown teachers. We'll chant Om Namah Shivaya Gurave, or rather, I will chant it over our connection, and you will each chant it to yourselves. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave. Sachit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambayate Jase. And a verse that often comes after it that almost automatically comes to my mind when I chant it. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahe Tejasvi Navaditamastu Ma vidvishavahe, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. And these words, this last verse means, may we be peaceful together, may we learn together, may we never be negative towards each other, and may our knowledge turn into light. In that spirit, we're going to begin our Q&A, and also asking that the power of the inner guru, the inner teacher, Shiva, whose nature is awareness, beingness and blissfulness be present within us to answer our questions, even to ask our questions, and to receive the knowledge that is being showered on us every time we gather in this Sangham. So, Deb, do you have some questions that we want to start with?
Some questions from the list. And for everybody else, if you want to ask a question, you just hit an asterisk, star, two, and when I get through with these questions, I can hit those people that have raised their hand, so to speak. So the first question I have, Jane asks, does mantra matter? And then she goes on to say, is the medicine Buddha appropriate now? For example, she works in a hospital with many COVID patients, or is a mantra to Shiva or Shakti a better choice? And should we stay with the same mantra over days or rotate mantras an acceptable strategy?
Terrific question. So I just want to say that we're all so grateful to you for working in the hospital, working in the healthcare system at this time, and to all of you who are doing that. So, yes, mantra matters. I think that what your question was does it matter which mantra? And I just get into that in a second. But yeah, it's absolutely fine to invoke the medicine Buddha if the medicine Buddha is meaningful to you. Another form of the divine who is considered to be a healing presence is, you know, actually a form of Vishnu, who is the sort of healing presence that you know, one of the healing presences in this tradition. Shiva himself is sometimes described as the physician who cures the disease of worldliness, which is arguably at the root of all of our physical diseases. So depending on your relationship to the mantra, that is, how much you've internalized it, how strongly you're able to concentrate on it, that will be the power that the mantra has, both to uplift you and to serve as a healing power. I actually, when I'm in a situation like the one you're talking about, or when I'm dealing with my own physical issues, my go-to mantra is Om Namah Shivaya, as I think it is for many of you. Om Namah Shivaya, which first of all was the mantra my guru originally gave me, but it's a mantra with an enormous backlog of healing energy attached to it. The same is true for the mantra Om. The same is true for the Vaishnava mantras like Om Namo Narayanaya, which a couple of people have mentioned in this class. So the mantra that has the most mojo for you is the one you should use on a regular basis. And if I were you working in the system, I would try to keep mantra going on at a, you know, kind of subliminal level as much as possible, and spend some of your leisure hours doing intense mantra practice. And I want to add one more piece, which I'm really not touting as a cure for infectious disease, but it's a very, very powerful practice for healing what's behind an infectious disease, that is the issues of your subtle immune system. And it sometimes can be actually kind of miraculously curative. Again, I'm going to tell you this practice and to stress that it's not an accepted medical practice, but it can have a very powerful healing effect, as you know, as practices like Reiki and others can do. But since if you're working with COVID-19 patients, you are not obviously going to want to touch them. What you can ask people who have a strong connection with, to just put their hands on their hearts, on their chest, and breathe, and you can say the mantra silently or out loud to them. And again, this isn't always something that's acceptable, but it's something that can be very powerful in a sick room. And if you're, you know, dealing with a relative or a friend who has this disease or any other disease, sometimes the only thing you can do for them is to sit with them and repeat the mantra, repeat your mantra. It's profoundly effective, and it actually does affect the minds of the people you're with, as you may know. It's so, yes, mantra matters. It's okay to work with a mantra that comes up for you in the moment that feels like it's where the healing energy or the calming energy wants to go. And it's also okay to use the mantra that you most usually practice with, because very often that's going to be the one that has the most power, not only to soothe you, but also to affect the atmosphere around you. So thank you very much for that question, Jane, and super, super blessings to you.
So I have another question from Charles, who asks if there is a difference between Ishvara and Atman. Is Ishvara a personal manifestation of Atman?
Oh, great question. Okay, so the word Atman in the Indian tradition is often used in two ways. The Atman, the self within an individual, is called the Jivatman, literally the individual self. The large self, which is the self of the universe, is called Paramatman, the supreme self, which is a kind of let's say, gender neutral non-sectarian word for the divine. So, and one of the core teachings of the non-dual texts of India, the non-dual philosophies of India, is Atman is Brahman. So the self is the absolute. Brahman is another word for the absolute. In the Patanjali tradition, at least from what the sutra and the commentators, traditional commentators on it say, Ishvara is personal deity, personal God, personal, the Ishta Devata, the personal form of God that many people in devotional traditions tune themselves to, take refuge in, worship and honor. In Kashmir Shaivism, and this is my own viewpoint in the understanding of how the vast, endless, ever blissful, supreme consciousness that is the underlying source of everything, in the process by which that supreme consciousness manifests as a physical world, there is a stage in which consciousness takes the form that's called Ishvara. And it's like one or two tiny transformations, let's say down from the ultimate formless consciousness. In other words, that formless presence that we call Paramatman or Supreme Consciousness or Brahman condenses itself into a form, and that's what's called Ishvara. Now, the form, and this is something that I've found very interesting in my explorations of deity, the form can be, it can be the form of a specific, let's say, sectarian deity. That is to say, the yogi form of Shiva with the snakes around his neck and his bare chest and his form as a yogi meditating in the Himalayas or as the dancing Shiva of the Nataraj statues. It can be Krishna, it can be Devi, it can be Durga or Lakshmi or Lalita or Kali. It can also, I believe, be that form that in Christianity is worshipped as Christ. It can be the the major deity of any world religion, actually. In some of course, the Western religions, the Supreme Reality is not considered to have a form, but nonetheless, the Ishvara is, you know, the idea of personal divinity, of the God who knows your name, is very much a part of the Jewish tradition, of the Islamic tradition. So even though they don't like to give an iconic form, they very much worship the Lord, Ishvara, as, you know, as a focal point of practice. So the specific, I would say, universality and gift that the non-dual traditions of Hinduism offer us is this understanding that the consciousness, the self within you, the Atman within you, is not different in kind or quality than the great self, the great Atman. So Ishvara and the self, yeah, there's actually a verse in Sanskrit, Ishvara Guru Atmeti. It means God, Guru, and self are one. And it points to a very profound form of non-duality, where you are able to be present to the godness within the universe, or the godness that you find in your meditation, and sort of hold a position of awe and honor of the vastness and the greatness of Ishvara, while at the same time recognizing that even though you may not be feeling it at this moment, yourself and that profound, vast consciousness are not different. And this is core non-duality, at least in my experience, actually beginning to hold the idea that Atman and Brahman, the felt sense of being within you, and that quality of radical grace that we call Ishvara, that they are not different. So, again, thank you.
We have someone raising their hands on the call-in. So I believe they're in Vermont.
That would be me.
Hi.
Hi,
hi,
you.
Who is this?
This is Barry.
Hi, Barry.
Hi. Okay, I'm going to preface this question with a belief that in this profound shift, we're moving from a place of patriarchy to a more balance between the sexes. So with that in mind, and knowing that Patanjali is not even known to be a person, can we consider Patanjali a female? Or why is it that it's assumed that Patanjali is male?
Really good question. Well, if Patanjali is a person, it's very likely that Patanjali is not one person, but an entire tradition, a lineage tradition, whose teachings have been collected under the name Patanjali. So there's many ways to understand Patanjali. I understand Patanjali, I have to tell you, as kind of a stream of wisdom that moves through the world, because as you are probably noticing, a lot of these sutras actually describe human experience on the spiritual path that is universal. That said, the Patanjali sutras come from a time and a place that was radically patriarchal, where the spiritual practitioners who were addressed were male. And if you're, you know, if you're familiar with traditional gender roles in that particular period in India and in most of the world, the positions of men and women were very different. So, and there are some communities in India where that's still true, and of course it's true all over the Middle East. So in the sense that Patanjali's wisdom is universal wisdom, of course it's utterly gender-free. And part of what has allowed me to really tune into these texts, which do indeed come out of traditions that are pre-modern, and that are have a kind of combination of universal values, universal wisdom, and but also include the culture, you know, a belief, as it were, in the cultural norms of their time, that I would say we get to learn how to distill the universal wisdom from, you know, from its cultural accretions. And, you know, so I would just go further in understanding the way these texts came down, that the truth is, from a tantric point of view, or from a, you know, from a Shaiva point of view, from a Trika or Shakta tantric point of view, the guru is always Shakti. So when we are working with liberating teachings like these, ultimately they do come from Shakti, who, though at that level Shakti and Shiva are really beyond gender, nonetheless Shakti is, of course, the feminine aspect of the divine consciousness. And one of the profound truths that's encoded in Trika philosophy, in the commentary to the Sutras on Recognition that we studied together a couple of years ago, is that the teachings and the teacher, the true teachings and the true teacher, come from the Anugrahaka Shakti, the grace-bestowing power that is intrinsic in the fabric of the universe, that is the power of liberation and revelation of the divine. So yeah, we can definitely consider these teachings to have come from the divine feminine. Perhaps she chose to channel through a male sage, given the time and place, but she probably channeled these same teachings through the very secret lineages of female goddess practitioners who maintained very powerful, very liberation-focused pocket sangha that existed in various parts of the different Eastern spiritual traditions. They're still alive today. Many of them started out as being quite secret, and are more apparent these days, especially, you know, in our time. So, these teachings are not really from the patriarchy, even though they may be spoken in language that feels patriarchal at times. They come from the heart of the universe, which is Shakti. Mm. So thanks, Barry.
And thank you.
Yeah.
It helps me.
Good. Helps me too. So I think we really need to as we enter into these teachings to sense that they are unrestricted, right? And their source is unrestricted. They're truth bearing teachings, which means that they're absolutely beyond gender.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got a technical question. Is it okay to practice different methods of meditation in one setting, or is it better to separate them?
No, that is a great question. Full disclosure, I do both. There are certainly times when you're sitting in meditation and you've begun with a particular protocol or a particular sequence, and at some point within the meditation, there will come a strong impulse to, let's say, create a variation, even move from the mantra that you've been doing to a different mantra, to focus on a different center than the one that you started with. And here's what I would say about it. what we have to learn is when the kind of impulse to shift practices in the middle of a meditation session, when that impulse is coming from the mind or from mental distraction or from doubt, and when that impulse is actually an impulse of the Shakti. You know, so as I think many of you know, you'll very often in meditation, as you get deeper, there's the energy within your body, the meditation energy, starts to do something with your focal point, so that perhaps you've started out doing this practice that we're working with today, and you know, moving with the breath between the heart and the Ajna Chakra, or between the nostrils, the bridge of the nose, the heart, and the Ajna Chakra, and you'll feel that your meditation wants to center in the heart, or as some people have suggested, that you want to ground yourself by allowing your meditation to move down into the Hara, into the pelvic area. Or you might just find that the energy wants to go up into the Ajna. And when that happens, that is what I call an authentic prompt or intuitive prompt to allow what is happening in meditation to happen. So that's a very important aspect of the art of meditation, to know when you're being given a direction by your own meditation energy and to follow it without feeling rigidly inclined to stick with the protocol that you're being given. Now, if what you're asking is, should we do one of the practices that only one of the practices that we are being offered, or can we use part of our meditation to work with a different practice, I actually think it's more fruitful to use one approach per session. Unless, as I say, it begins to, you know, morph on its own. So you might do one particular practice during your morning session, a different one during an afternoon session, or perhaps you might take some time when you have just free moments, or to do a contemplation or a meditation that you're wanting to experiment with. I believe very much in infusing meditative practices into different activities. So when you're walking or washing dishes, or in certain cases driving, not every practice is good to do while driving, but some of them are. And, you know, and to start to realize how mingling a meditative awareness with daily life is so effective in infusing your daily life with spirit. So, again, thank you for the question. Basically one practice per session, but let it morph if that's what it wants to do.
Okay, our next question is on Sutra 23. Ishvara Pradhana is very powerful conceptually, but how do I do this surrender on a regular basis, as the ego can easily disguise itself in it seeing that I am surrendering?
So true. So true. Okay, so this sutra actually is one of the sutras that we could take as our entire spiritual practice. Seriously, that is, it's the practice of asking yourself, what does the Shakti want at this moment? What does God want? How can I let go of my thoughts, my preoccupations, my fears? You know, a person who's really doing this sadhana of surrender, who's like cultivating the sadhana of surrender, is going to get to the point where it actually becomes something that we want to be conscious of pretty much all the time. And when you're starting to be conscious of surrender, what of course we also become conscious of is the way in which the difference between the way ego surrenders and the surrender that actually naturally arises. So, and we come across what is arguably one of the kind of big issues in the development of our capacity for true surrender, our capacity for compassion, our capacity for gratitude. In other words, these qualities which we cultivate in sadhana, in practice, ultimately are not under our control. In other words, true surrender, ultimate surrender, is what arises when the divine force, when the Shakti, rises and takes us into a state in which the ego naturally dissolves or lies down or sort of places herself at the feet of the Shakti. And this experience of having the Shakti rise up and draw you into a state of surrender is usually, for most of us, the result of quite a lot of practice. Because when something like that happens, you know, in the early days of practice, it often gives rise to quite a lot of fear that we then have to work with. And, of course, fear is one of the ego's early and last resorts. The ego somehow intuits that if we truly practice surrender, if we truly relax into the underlying grace that wants to lift us, if we truly relax, the ego is going to have to give up, let go, and to the ego that feels like death. I personally think that the tendency in the yoga world to see surrender as this kind of death to the ego process, where you kind of beat up the ego, you look at all the reasons for not thinking of yourself as special, et cetera, and you think that in order to surrender, you have to become, a kind of wimp of with no backbone and, no personal desires. The truth is that surrender is something that we cultivate over and over again over a period of time. And, for instance, one aspect of surrender is to, let's say you're sitting in meditation. It's not feeling very comfortable or pleasant today. What surrender is called for? Some of the surrender, for instance, in that situation, part of the surrender may be just saying, okay, I'm having the meditation I'm having. I can surrender to the fact that this is not my most exciting meditation session ever, and just let that be as it is. That itself is a powerful surrender, and often once we've done that process of simply accepting what is, then the sense of obstruction that we may have been feeling will in and of itself dissolve. We're just constantly being faced with situations in life where we have to do something that feels unpleasant and are feeling resistant, and then surrender consists of letting go of the resistance and just stepping into what we have to do. And, the ego, the sense of why do I have to do this, or I'm so good for doing this, and all the other permutations of the personal egoic tendency to claim experience for our small self, all these things will come up. And in the process, we learn to recognize, oh, this is what ego looks like when I'm in resistance. This is what ego looks like when I'm experiencing self-satisfaction because I'm doing so well at this practice. This is what ego looks like when, I compare myself to somebody else. And those, of course, are just the sort of obvious aspects of ego. Ego has its tendrils into every aspect of us. So in in working with your question, one of the things that my guru used to say that I found extremely helpful is that when you're practicing surrender in the deepest sense, that part of it involves just recognizing that the ego manifestations are actually aspects of Shakti, that they're, you know, that when the mind moves into holding or tension or tightness in all of its permutations, you know, when you start to feel the ego in the body as tight shoulders or a contracted belly, that if you just say, okay, this too is a manifestation of Shakti, there will be an automatic release, maybe not a huge one at that moment, but a little bit of letting go. And that itself is a form of surrender. So what I would like to encourage for all of you is that you take this sutra, and it comes back again and again in the Yoga Sutras, and it comes back again and again in our practice, that you take this sutra as a kind of a mantra that, you know, with mantra, sometimes when we're doing a mantra practice, it's completely open for us, you know, it's vibrant for us. And sometimes we're doing the mantra and, you know, it just seems boring and repetitive and not interesting. So with surrender also, there'll be times when you can just say to yourself, surrender, or what is God's will in this situation, or whatever version of the practice you're using as a prompt. And it will immediately remove your sense of being stuck. And there are times when, you know, the voice of protest, the voice of resistance comes back and says, yeah, right, surrender to this, are you kidding? So there's a lot of wobble here. There's a lot of wriggle room in our practice of surrender. And the underlying recognition, we're actually going to talk about it in the next class, is to have the intention always to consider what is the underlying truth in this situation. Sometimes by underlying truth we mean the actual mundane truth, what's really happening here. But what the sutras are talking about and what I want to point you to is just being aware, just reminding yourself that there is this field of grace that is supporting us and that is there whether you're lost in, you know, resistance or you're having an egoic tantrum or somebody is just treating you like shit and you're furious about it, or you've just done something that, you know, just does not feel like your best self, to recognize that there is this grace that underlies it all and that often surrender is just being aware that you are supporting a field of grace no matter how it seems at this moment, and just taking a big breath, exhaling and asking for grace. Someone wrote to me personally, not to the listserv, about how you ask for grace when you're not, when there's no personal guru or deity figure that you're connected to. And what I want to say, what I said to her, and what I want to say here is that the field of grace is really non-dual. It's ever-present. For some of us, it's best. The best way to tune into it is through our connection to a deity or a teacher. In other words, we are yogis who respond to form. And there are many of us who just are learning to feel into the particles of prana in the atmosphere, to the feeling of the touch of the air on our face, to the sight of a tree or the feeling of connection to another person or to a beautiful thought or idea, and to recognize grace present in all of these things. and, you know, to just be willing to kind of throw ourselves open to say, I don't really understand what I am, what grace is, what this situation wants to teach me. But I'm willing to allow wisdom, love, skill to arise, knowing that I am supported by the power of grace, which is always available, and to surrender that way, to say, okay, I may feel contracted, but I know grace is there, so let me just open to it. I hope that helps answer your question. There's, as I said, there is a world of practices and ways of understanding that can help us deeply enter into the sadhana of Ishvara Pranidhan. And we'll be going into it again and again. So thank you. Deb?
I just unmuted someone that had raised their hand, one of our callers.
If you have your hand raised in Mill Valley, you're on the air.
Oh, good. Can you hear me, Sally?
Yes, totally.
Hi. Yeah, so there are times when I long for a guru to tell me this is the right practice for you to do at this time, and that's not the way things unfold, at least in my life right now, but I'm very grateful for you and your teachings and just trying to figure out how to bring them into my meditation practice. I'm 54 and I've been meditating since I was 12 on and off. And recently I did write to you about this. I was learning about meditating with the body through Reggie Ray, and that really enlivened my practice. I realized I had been disassociating a lot when meditating. But now I'm starting to feel a little ADHD with it. Like there's just so much roaming the body and opening the body and listening to the body, but I need more of a concentration practice that's in the body. And I'm just, I was trying to do the meditation you gave us of breathing into the heart area and then exhaling up to the Agni chakra. And that just felt like too much upper body. But then bringing in the lower body, it just felt clumsy and awkward. So I feel like I'm struggling in my practice that I need more concentration and focus. My next step, but how to do that in a way that's not disassociated, that's very embodied. I guess that's my question. I hope that makes sense.
Makes total sense. It's a really good question.
Okay.
So one of the reasons that I often teach meditation with a focus in the heart is because the heart really is kind of the bridge between the lower body and the upper body. So for many people, meditation with the focus in the heart, which would be in this instance inhaling with the breath into the heart and letting the heart just kind of expand with the exhalation, would be an embodying practice. But what I'm going to suggest is that you kind of turn this practice into a heart hara practice. You know, I know that Reggie teaches a meditation where you inhale through the belly, right? You imagine that the breath is coming in through the belly, which is a classic Taoist meditation on the hara, the spiritual center between the belly button and the top of the pubic bone in the very middle of the body. This is one of the very grounded spiritual centers in the body. So I would suggest that you, if you want to do a body scan, do it for a couple of minutes at the start of meditation just to anchor yourself in the body, and then begin to do this breath practice, moving in through the nostrils down to the heart, and then from the heart down to the hara, and then exhaling from the hara to the heart. And what will happen as you do this, because this is a practice that actually begins to open both those centers and will also connect you to the central channel, which runs between, it runs from the base of the body all the way up through the crown and runs into the center of the earth below and up into, you know, the higher regions above. We tune into the central channel, most of us, by a kind of vertical meditation involving the breath. And it starts out by being, you know, very concentrated, very focused. And at a certain point, as the channel opens up or as the chakras open up, we find ourselves in a naturally indrawn and much more subtle state. So my suggestion is that you incorporate the hara into the breath practice.
Okay, so can I just make sure I have this correct, that I would breathe in my nostril to my heart center and then exhale down to my hara?
Well, you could do it that way. But I would actually suggest doing it as a inhalation that goes in from through the nostrils down through the heart into the hara.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And then the exhalation moves up from the hara and expands the heart. You know, so there are different teachers will give you different directions for the breath, for the prana, you know, that some teachers will tell you that the inhalation should be upward and the exhalation downward. In the tantric approach to breath, the prana shakti is considered to be connected with the exhalation, and it's considered to be a rising breath, and the apana is connected with the inhalation and is considered to be a downward breath. So I find that when you inhale downward, down to the deeper centers in the body, and then exhale upward, that it actually lifts your consciousness with the exhalation, and it tends to be expansive. So with the inhalation, think of grounding in the hara, and then with the exhalation, think of expanding through the heart.
Okay.
So that would be my direction, and try it. All of you can try it now if you want, and just give me a report after you've done it for a few sessions. See how it works for you.
Okay, so I would be moving between the hara and the heart.
That would be moving between the hara and the heart, starting out in the, with feeling the breath in the nostrils, because that in itself is a grounding practice.
Yes.
And just following the sensory trail of the breath down through the center of the body into the hara, and then following the trail of the exhalation up into the heart. So I find that if you're really focusing on the breath, that the breath is leaving it has a kind of an energetic signature that is embodied. You know, the breath is embodied, and it's also everywhere. Prana is everywhere. So it kind of allows you to embody, and it gives you a place of focus. Especially if you're practicing with one of these centers in the body. And it also is expansive. You know, so you're not making yourself stuck in the dullness of the physical body in the name of embodiment. You're actually tuning into the aliveness, the sparkling, shakti-filled quality of the body. The non-materiality, the intelligence within the body. When you really use the breath and the connection to these centers as your focal point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you so much, especially that last bit you said, because there is a sort of dullness and heaviness of the body. At the same time, I'm aware I need that grounding of that container, at least right
yeah.
now in practice. But I miss the shakti. So thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome, and let us know how it goes.
Okay, I'll look. I'm looking forward to practicing that. Can't wait for my next meditation.
Yes, yes. I want to say one thing that grounding is super important. Obviously, you know, it's very important to bring our attention into the lower body, partly in order to bring it alive, because most of us live in our heads, being the nature of modern society. But as when we do it, we want to tune into the Shakti in the lower body, which is right there in the cells, you know, your intestines and your womb and your testicles and your vagina and your inner belly and all of these things in the lower body that we don't pay attention to unless we have a stomach ache or unless we're sexually aroused or have indigestion or taking a shit or something. These very, very physical aspects of ourselves are also infused with subtlety and Shakti. And by bringing that awareness into them with a practice like this, then our body starts to not be experienced as this kind of subtle, dense, you know, fully material substance. It starts to reveal its Shakti, its subtlety to us. And that's been one of the revelations of, you know, my practice over the last 10 years. And for those of you know, and it's something that I think Reggie, who I do think is a very good teacher, discovered at a certain point in his practice. You know, that's why I think that book is meaningful to you, because it's not just based on, you know, on a understanding of the body as physical, but as understanding of the body as really a gateway into the subtle. And so that's how we want to do our embodied practice, is with the recognition that the body is the physical body is also the subtle body. The subtle body is not really separate in any way from the physical body.
Thank you.
Welcome.
All right, we have another question. When you are following the breath, breathing in and tracing the breath from the heart to the third eye, do you trace it with your eyes internally, if eyes are closed, or keep fixated on one center?
Oh, interesting question. I have actually never had the experience of tracing it with my eyes, and my feeling is that that's probably something that you can let go of. What you trace it with is your attention. So, you know, it's one of the great teachings of the modern wellness movement, actually, that when the mind and the breath, when the attention and the breath are connected, that your attention and breath can pretty much open up, expand, and even heal anything that you fix it on. So in this practice that we're talking about, my suggestion would be that you try as best you can to anchor your attention, that part of your mind which gives attention, to the breath itself, to the felt sense of the breath moving in the body, to the center, to your felt sense of the center as the breath impacts it. And at a certain point, one of the centers will tend to come into the foreground very often. So it may be that you find yourself, so to speak, fixated in the heart or fixated in the ajna, or as in the practice we were just discussing with Undine, fixated in the hara. But really your anchor is the breath in this particular practice. And the breath will, so to speak, deposit your attention in different places as meditation becomes deeper. And the art of concentration, the art of concentrative meditation, is the art of making the mind and the breath join together. And, you know, using the mind to direct the breath, or using the breath to dissolve the scatteredness of the mind. But it's all about where you hold your attention. So the breath is the string, the breath is the rope, the breath is the guide rail that allows your mind to let go of its scatteredness, which is a normal quality of mind, and just come back again and again and again to a one-pointed focus. It's following the breath with your eyes can actually cause some stress, some strain. However, I can also, as I consider your question, what I would like to ask you is whether, when you say following it with your eyes, you mean following it with your inner visual sense, which is a, you know, actually a very strong and helpful process in a concentrative meditation. If you are actually visualizing the movement of the breath as the breath is moving, that's a terrific way of concentrating. Moving your eyes, your physical eyes, in this particular practice may not be so helpful. Though if you find that it does help your focus, you know, it's fine with me if you experiment with it. But consider that it's not the eyes that are seeing these pathways. It's the inner visual sense, the inner sense of sight, which is actually prior to the physical eyes and which is subtler than the physical eyes and which is present in subtle experiences such as, you know, when we have a vision of, or when we're able to kind of get a visual sense of the movement of the breath or a visual sense of a chakra. It's not the eyes that are seeing it. It's your inner sense of sight. So again, thank you for that question. It's a very interesting contemplation that it gave rise to for me and hopefully for the rest of you as well.
So they also go on to say, sometimes when entering into deeper meditation, it feels as if the breath stops and it becomes distracting, and then they gasp for breath and break the meditative thread, and they're asking for any suggestions on that.
Okay, so this is actually a very normal experience, and when the breath slows down and stops, it is an indication that the breath is actually moving into the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel. So, you know, as many of you know, when the breath is normal, so to speak, active, when we're outwardly focused, the breath moves through the two channels on the right and left side of the inner body, the Ida and Pingala nadis, and sometimes one of those channels is imbalanced or stuck, and that's why we do Nadi Shodhana, the alternate nostril breathing, to start to balance these two channels through which breath moves. At a certain point, as you go deep in meditation, as you go deeper in meditation, the breath is no longer moving in and out of these channels. It begins to move inside the central channel. This is something that we can practice, but which in its most powerful form happens spontaneously. And when that happens, the breath stops. So when we're not used to it, or when we're, you know, when it startles us, then there will be a tendency to gasp and try to breathe again. My suggestion is twofold. First, that you allow yourself to look at this pause in the breath, at this stillness of the breath, as actually the fruit of your practice. Look at it as a positive thing and see if you can relax into it. To help you do that, I want to pass on to you a piece of advice that I got back in my early days of doing breath practice, which I found difficult because my breath would stop and I would get scared. And I think many of us have have fear attached to the breath for various reasons. So this teacher said to me, forget who's breathing. Just let the breath happen. And that's actually turned out to be a very helpful instruction. You can kind of, okay, the breath is happening. And in fact, I don't have to gasp for breath, because once this yogic state of breath stopping happens, you are actually being breathed by the prana shakti, which is deep in the Sushumna Nadi, and which can support you for days and weeks, according to the old yogis. And our process in the art of deepening our meditation is to just learn day by day the art of just being able to relax in those moments when the breath has stopped, and not try to recapture our normal outgoing state. When we first start having these experiences, they often feel scary, mainly because we're not used to them. But the more they come and the more you are willing to work with them as they are, the more you learn their purpose and the more you begin to enjoy them and cultivate them, and then you can really, really go deep in meditation. So see if you can allow a kind of relaxation when the breath stops. And if you can't, and if you gasp, then just go back to practice after you come out of meditation. Know that it's all right. And know that eventually, sooner or later, you'll be able to relax into that actually very beautiful state where the breath naturally pauses and you begin to experience the quiet that can arise when the breath pauses or stops. Because as so many of the yogic texts say, when the breath pauses, the mind pauses. And our job is to let that be as it is so that it can deepen. So thank you guys so much for entering into this. We'll do another Q&A session farther along in the course. And if you have questions that weren't answered, just please send them into the listserv and I will answer them on the listserv, and other people might also offer their insights. So let's, as we close, let's close our eyes. And for now, follow the breath into the heart. And with the exhalation, allow the heart to expand. Expanding upward, expanding downward, expanding to the front, expanding to the sides. And just let yourself relax in the rhythm of the breath. And let's complete our practice with one Om. Om. I'm going to do one more. Om. We offer our practice, our wisdom, our love, asking that everything we do and say here be of benefit to all beings, that it be healing, and that it bring blessing to the earth herself. Namaste. Have a beautiful rest of your day or evening.